Let's rewind. It's 1999. A handful of smart and geeky people have started doing something new on the World Wide Web. They're logging what they find there, commenting on it, sharing it. People are reading and commenting back. There's 23 of these web logs by one count in that year where someone called for the first time the shortened name, blog. That word became the Merriam-Webster word of the year by 2004. Fast forward now to 2006. There are 50 million blogs. Political blogs, art blogs, do-it-yourself blogs, blogs about blogs. There are platforms like WordPress to help you write and post your own blog. Serious journalists, publications, NPR has a blog. Everybody is doing it. And now? Well, here's some headlines from the past year on Google. Is blogging finally dead? Blogging is dead. Long live blogging. And from the New Republic, what were blogs? I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman today on KCUR Central Standard. Not everyone thinks blogging is dead yet, but clearly things have changed since its frenzied peak a decade ago. Why is that? And what's next for the person who has something they want to share with the world that's longer than 140 characters and doesn't get lost in an endless river of posts? Well, someone who's surely interested in that is Beverly Widener. Bev, you're a survivor. You produce the Bev Cooks blog from your home here in Kansas City. Welcome.
Well, hi. Thank you.
What did you do before you were a blogger?
Well, I had no idea there were 50 million blogs. Whatever you just said, I feel so tiny. Oh, my goodness.
Well, they haven't all made it, as it turns out.
They haven't all. Well, before I was blogging, I was working downtown as an office manager, and I was getting coffees and getting lunches and, you know, curating some artists that were coming in every month for First Friday. And while I loved the people that I was around, I was so stagnant. I just felt so directionless at that point.
And so feeling directionless, you thought to yourself, what I should do is start a weblog.
Yeah.
What is that? How did that happen?
Well, you know, before I started the weblog, I live journaled forever ago, and that was in the late 90s.
Now, what does that mean, live journal?
So live journal was like one of those original platforms of people blogging, you know, if you want to call it that.
Before they were blogs.
It was sort of the same thing, but it was like everybody had, it was all called the same thing, live journal slash whatever your username is. And so you could follow people on there. It was sort of a smaller platform for people that wanted to follow each other. It was before Facebook, I think. Yeah, I think it was before Facebook. And it was a lot of fun. And I, you know, I just wrote nothing about food. It was just back when it was just brain vomit, you know, just blah, 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 blah. But so fast forward all of to that, and I was just feeling sort of directionless and getting interested in food. I had just gotten married a few years before that, and I was just really interested in learning how to cook and wanting to talk about my journey with cooking. And I thought, you know, I was starting to read blogs back then at my job.
Yeah.
And really, you know, like, these people have something to say. Well, so do I. I have something to say. And it kind of started from there.
And so you mentioned you write about food. Bev Cooks is a food blog. That's a pretty vibrant subset of the blogging world from the beginning, I think, and still today. For someone who's never seen yours, give us a sense. What is Bev Cooks?
Oh, goodness. It is a train wreck. It's, you know, way back in the day, in the early years, I was posting 5 days a week, all food recipes. And I was also, here's another like important factor, like I was in the depths of infertility back then. So blogging for me was this source of escape, you know, reading blogs and writing a blog and, you know, getting into food photography and getting into recipe development. It took my mind off of everything that was making me sad. Mm. And it gave me this huge sense of joy. So I focused on that, and I, you know, eventually quit my job and launched the website, you know, bought the domain, my girlfriend designed it, you know, we were very excited about it, and there it was. And that first year I just dove in and wrote all the time and photographed all the time and, you know, studied magazines. I had no idea what I was doing. I still don't. Like, I really don't. But I just pretend to know what I'm doing. And
well, and you're obviously doing it pretty well. You're still doing it 10 years later.
Yeah,
eight years. I hear you saying a lot of things that you felt directionless. You had these things you wanted to say. You were dealing with some personal issues.
Sure.
I mean, it all sounds very very much like, no offense, but like it was about you. It wasn't about like these the content being important for the world to have. It was important for you to get it out of you.
Sure. That's a good point. At that point, nobody knew that it was about me. For them, they knew it was just about the recipes at that point. But then when I went through IVF. And so when I finally opened up about getting pregnant, going through IVF, the whole story, the whole blog itself widened and became bigger. My voice just got so much bigger because there were so many women came out of the woodworks like that were struggling as well and are struggling still and found like a sense of happiness and peace in what I was talking about, you know, and like I'm going through this. And I, you know, if you've ever read my blog, it's not serious. It is a joke. It all comes from a humorous background. My dad's really funny, so I kind of got that from him. And never take anything too seriously. And that's kind of what the writing is about. And so to have that sort of avenue for people to listen to come for the recipes, to come for the story, to come for the voice, to come for the photos, whatever they're coming for.
It's a lot of like what people used to say about the NPR program Car Talk. It purports to be about cars, but it's not really about cars.
It's not really about cars.
It sounds like your food. You write a food blog that's not really about food.
Yeah, it's kind of like Seinfeld, the show about nothing. The blog's about nothing and everything.
You know, I'm curious about the technical side of all this too. I mean, you run a pretty professional blog, frankly. Mm-hmm. You're selling it short. It's very slick. It's well designed. It's not really someone just sitting at home in their slippers and pushing send. Occasionally.
Oh, they're nice slippers.
Oh, well, very good. You've earned that. I guess I'm curious how this became that. I mean, how did it become more than this just opportunity for some self-expression that you felt like you needed to being, well, it is your actual job.
It is. You know, I started with a Tumblr account. I had a friend of mine a long time ago tell me, you need to do a Tumblr. And that was the easiest way for me to wrap my head around the technical stuff, because I am so technically challenged, it's not funny. But my girlfriend in Portland,
and Tumblr, you literally you type or you upload a picture and you push send and
it
appears.
And it just appears and it's kind of like a role, you know. There aren't real categories unless Tumblr has changed. I don't exactly know.
But you put stuff at the top and
it scrolls. Yeah. And so I knew that I wanted to get a little bit more serious with it. And so my girlfriend designed it all in Portland. So she knows exactly what she was doing there, and we worked through that together. And then, you know, it's a WordPress website, and so she kind of held my hand through, here, click this. Click purchase.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I have an ad network that I'm with, and they run all the ads. They run all the behind the scenes as far as, like, where to place ads, what to do, what to push, what not to push. Uh-huh. So I have nothing to do with that, which is so nice. I just sit back and I let them do that. And if I've got, you know, technical problems, I go to my girlfriend, Michelle, and she does it. And it's so nice, you know.
Well, let me bring Dan Gilmore into the conversation. He's joining us by Skype from Phoenix, where he's a professor of practice at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication at Arizona State. Dan, welcome to Central Standard.
Glad to be here.
And that's a very serious title for you, I just read, which is some of the reputation blogs have had, or at least started with, is that they aren't really all that serious. Is that fair to say?
Well, it's like pretty much anything. You know, 95% of anything that we create that people do widely is not going to be professional, or and that's putting it nicely. But it's everything from great to terrible. And I celebrate that. It's people creating media. Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's
and
sort of the
being part of this.
I'm sorry. That's sort of the interesting thing, it seems to me, about blogs is that their very unprofessionalness was sort of the attraction. And yet the ones that have succeeded have, in fact, been very professionally successful.
Indeed, they have, and some of them have turned into serious businesses over the years. And we got to keep in mind a couple things. First, it's a blog is just a website. Mm-hmm. It's of a particular kind, if it's the traditional sort, where the newest stuff goes at the top, and it's reverse chronological. But it's software. It's a tool, and it's used in all kinds of interesting and often fabulous ways. And I have to say, I, as somebody who's been doing it since 1999, when this stuff first started, it's something that I recommend people try.
Is Bev's story a pretty typical one, Dan, in your experience for how a blog starts and then grows and develops?
I wouldn't call it typical. I'd call it typical of that genre, where it starts and it grows into something of substance, but most do not. And I think what she's doing is fantastic. And it's exactly the sort of thing that I was hoping for in the early days where when everybody was able to start creating media, that was the flowering of a whole new kind of media that we're still seeing the effect of.
And it did flower. It flowered fast, and it flowered huge. But then is it fair to say that it is fading to some extent now?
It's entirely fair to say that, because social networks have captured a lot of the conversation that goes on online. And blogging at the beginning, this is really key for a long time. One of the most important aspects of blog writing, at least the kind I like to see, was that people were talking in their own voice. It was human conversation, and comments were part of blogs, and people reacted to each other. And the conversation, a lot of it, has moved on to social networks, which is both a good thing and kind of a scary thing.
Well, and that, I think, is maybe a key question, is what has been the impact of those social networks on the blogs. I want to get to that, but before that, I want to ask you, Dan. You know, you mentioned that that Bev's experience is typical of a successful blog. What are the marks of one that is successful, and what is she doing right that other blogs have not done that has led many to not be successful?
I would probably defer to her on her own experience, but the people I've seen who have made these things work and go on to be successful, whether as a business or simply as a personal expression, mm-hmm. That continues. The word I tend to come up with is relentless. People stay with it. They do it every day or often. Now there are some blogs where somebody updates once a week and it's a long and serious and wonderful thing. That's just as fine to me as anything else. But in the early days, people who posted a lot tended to attract the most audience for what they were doing. And I certainly know that when I started mine, which was as an adjunct to my job as a columnist at a newspaper in Silicon Valley, using software that a guy named Dave Weiner in Silicon Valley had created, I was constantly posting, and it was fantastic for building further audience.
Bev, as you look at the wreckage alongside the highway, as your blog keeps going down the road, what do you see in the blogs that really haven't made it, or that just never really caught on?
Well, I think that Dan's 100% right in saying that pushing out the content in those early days, like, you know, 5 days a week, that's what helped me in those early years. And commenting, that was another big thing for me. Like he said, people were encouraging each other. They were all over each other's blogs. And that's so different than it is nowadays. Like, I remember back then, eight years ago, there was this huge community of bloggers. Everyone was commenting on each other's sites every single day. And you know, that brings people to your site when you're commenting everywhere else. And that's what it kind of attracted people to me in those early days and weeks and months and years. And that's totally changed now, because no one has time to comment the way that they used to. No one has. You know, it's turned into such an industry, like I was saying earlier, an industry. It's a business that, you know, people now have virtual assistants. They're putting out cookbooks left and right. They've got shows. They're doing this. They're doing that. They're cooking segments all over. Everybody's doing big things, and nobody really has the time anymore to, hey, your lasagna looked so good.
Is that oregano on there?
Right.
I am curious to bring our listeners into the conversation, too. I mean, to our listeners, I say, do you blog, or did you used to? Do you read blogs? Do you still? Has that all changed for you the last few years or not? And if so, why? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. And we'll take some of those calls momentarily. I mean, let me ask you, Bev, how we're sort of getting at this this difficult place, or the coincidence of the industry, the financial vocational part of this for you, but also the personal satisfaction part of this for you. I'm curious, I mean, if you didn't have the blog, if you were a cookbook writer or Food Network host or something, would you still find that same sense of expression, or is there something about blogging that is uniquely important to you?
You know, it's this funny thing. There's something about blogging that's, it's something about being behind the laptop for me. It's being behind the camera. It's being behind the laptop that, and what's funny and sort of ironic is that I do a lot of selfie videos on Instagram, and Instagram has taken my blog in different ways than ever expected. Social media completely, like Dan was saying earlier, it's definitely hurt the industry because no one knows where to comment anymore. The you know, the feedback is so spread, it's spread thin, it's everywhere. You know, you can comment Pinterest, Facebook, Instagram stories. It's not, it's so different, but it's also very helpful in pushing traffic to the blog. But I get such a sense of joy being behind everything, if that makes sense.
and letting people respond to you wherever
exactly.
they find it.
Exactly.
Dan Gilmore, is what Bev describing accurate? Is the way that the way we get our information has changed? That's obviously changed the way people read blogs.
For sure. And we're still in an evolving ecosystem for media in general. And again, the power and reach of the major social networks is kind of a gravity well pulling in a lot of the conversation that people do in the online world.
Well, let's take a little break, and when we come back, we'll take some of your calls. We'll also talk about what's changed and what's changing. Is blogging, as we have known it, dying? If it is, what's replacing it? I'm Brian Ellison, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. Something has, it seems, changed in the world of blogging. A lot of big-name bloggers have actually given it up, stopped doing it. Numbers seem to be down. Why is that? And what's next? We'd love to hear from you about your experience as a consumer of blogs, 816-235-2888. And if you're a blogger yourself, or you used to be, we'd love to hear from you, too. We're talking here with the blogger Bev Widener, the author of the Bev Cooks blog, and also with Dan Gilmore from Arizona State. He's joining us by Skype. Let me ask you both what I just asked our listeners. Dan, are people blogging less? And if so, why?
You know, I don't know the exact answer to that, but I can tell you that WordPress, both the commercial hosting company and the not-for-profit blogging software that they give away, account for well over 20% of all the websites in the world. So people are starting these things all the time. I would be hard pressed to say that fewer are blogging, but certainly the character of how we look at it has changed.
And Bev, I mean, would you say your own blogging has changed or evolved over the last 8 years?
For sure. I think once I had my little kids, my twins, I have boy-girl twins, and once I had them, surprisingly, it opened up a new source of content for me. I started writing about awful parenting advice and DIY projects that go wrong with kids, and people love that. They get into that. Moms want to know that their kids aren't broken. They want to know that they're not alone. And so the whole mom, I would not ever say I'm a mommy blogger. I would say I'm a food and lifestyle blogger, lifestyle being the kids are in there, the home is in there, even some fashion stuff is in there, gardening stuff. It's all encompassing of my
life.
Because
it's your life.
Yes,
it's your life blog.
Exactly, my life
there,
blog.
There certainly are plenty of mommy blogs,
sure.
And probably daddy blogs too.
Yeah, absolutely. Dan,
there used to be a lot of news blogs, a lot of public affairs commentary and news gathering on blogs. Has that changed?
I think there's probably at least as much now as before, and I would think almost every major news organization and most smaller ones have blogs of some sort on their website. They sort of grow and then get cut back as people experiment, which is one of the values of this. And there's some extraordinarily good commentary and deep journalism going on in things that are for their blogs. For example, Josh Marshall, who started off as a solo blogger a long time ago, has a company now called Talking Points Memo that does all sorts of political journalism that's vital to read if you're into that. And SCOTUS blog covers the Supreme Court. And I could rattle off, you know, 100 of these things in if I had enough time. There's a lot of great stuff.
Well, and I mean, I you know, you mentioned Talking Points Memo, which starts off as a solo blog, but I think of now as sort of an amalgamation of a lot of different material. It doesn't look the way I think a blog traditionally looks anymore. And is that has are we using the word differently?
In a way, but again, as blogging software improved and evolved, what people could do with what had been very basic, designed to be simple to use and simple output, products became more interesting and complicated in terms of the way they look. And people who want to make businesses have to bring in layers of things like advertising or subscription models and that sorts of stuff. So the TPM site is still blogish in its main column with lots of stuff around the edges. But I still would call it a blog in its basic format.
Hmm. You've both mentioned WordPress. WordPress is this this basis for a lot of people's blogs. How important is WordPress, Dan, in the evolution and the history of blogging?
Well, the early blogging was largely from two companies. One was called Blogger, that Google purchased back in around 2002, if I have it right. And another one called Userland, started by the guy I mentioned before, that had a product called Manila, and those were the early major platforms, if you could call the early blogging a major phenomenon. Then Google didn't do a lot with Blogger. They've kept it going, and it's still there, and people start blogs there all the time. WordPress emerged from a bunch of competitors as the absolute linchpin of the software side of this, from my perspective. And the way they did it was to have a commercial side and a non-commercial side, where they host blogs for you for a fee if you want to have anything professionally done, and they give away the software. Open source is the term people mm-hmm. use, for people to set up their own, and they have an operation that does highly customized stuff for companies, big companies, and it's a pretty wonderful company because they've maintained the values of the open web. And found a way to make a very good profit at the same time while being a key, absolutely key source of what we all do.
Let's take some calls at 816-235-2888. Let's talk to Christian in Shawnee. Hello, Christian.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on.
I'm a palliative care physician, so helping with quality of life and serious illness. And in 2005, I joined a blog called PalliMed, written by a resident physician who was going into the field of palliative medicine. And he was writing great stuff about research in the field. And I was a fellow in training all by myself, and I was interested in what he was writing. And I asked if I could write with him. And we're still doing it 12 years later. And because of that writing, I actually got leadership opportunities that were opening up to me as a physician, even though I wasn't necessarily a great researcher or anything like that. I eventually got on the board of our National Physicians Group for Palliative Care and became the president last year, mostly because of my being known from writing for a blog.
And Christian, that's a, I don't want to say that's a really small niche, but that's a very focused particular purpose for a blog, palliative care medicine. Do you feel like that's part of its appeal, is that the people who want to read it are there to read just about that?
Yeah, because they're looking for information, and they're interested in their field. And But what's great is we've had physicians from other specialties and nurses from other specialties, you know, come find us. And we've had comments from patients and families who have been looking up things about certain symptoms or challenging situations with serious illness and have found our website and made comments. And it's been a really great interaction. I think I've learned as much as I've shared by getting comments and feedback from other people.
Well, Christian, I really appreciate you calling in. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
And one of the points Christian makes, Bev, is that he started just writing the blog, but it's led to other things. It's led to this leadership position for him, for example. How has your life changed since you became a blogger?
Oh, goodness. Yeah, Christian is 100% right. And I was nodding the whole time he was talking. I was like, exactly, exactly. It's amazing what you can, you know, writing out a soup recipe is going to take you, and you're going to end up on the Food Network one day. And that's kind of my life right now. And it's not kind of, it is. And it's pretty amazing. I have a show with them now. It's a digital 4-part series online, and it's a dream come true. It truly is, you know, and it's led me to freelance opportunities. It's led me to, I've traveled to Europe and back because of my blog, and met so many wonderful people all over everything, you know, and it's been incredible. It's a journey. It's just been I'm just along for the ride, man.
Well, you and a lot of other people, a lot of that ride takes place now, not just on your webpage
exactly.
itself. It takes place on Facebook and on
yep.
Twitter and on Instagram. I know you snapped an Instagram photo as soon as you got in the room here in the studio.
It's who I am.
I guess I'd ask you, Dan, how has the rise of other social media avenues changed blogging? Has it enhanced blogging, or has it proved to be competition?
On balance, it's more competition. I think we all have one serious limitation that we can't fix, and that's the amount of time we have.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do this stuff there as opposed to here, it means here gets less attention. So that's been a very major impact. And I'm one of the people who has moved a fair amount of my online conversation to the platforms, mostly Twitter. And I have really mixed feelings about that because the blog was, for me, so great as a platform for what I was doing for a long, long time. And
so why make the move?
Sure. Well, I think as people will tell you, that's where other people are.
Right.
Which is both a trap and an opportunity. I think I used the expression a gravity well before. It feels like, I don't want to call it a black hole, but it's really relentless in terms of how hard it is to not use the platforms if you want to do things in any kind of public way.
I certainly see plenty of people use those platforms at the very least for pointing people toward their blogs. Every time a new blog post goes up, they post it on Facebook and Twitter.
An absolutely great way to use platforms. And again, the platforms offer enormous value in their own ways. I would just hope that we find better ways to spread the conversation to sites that we own individually and that we control. I think everyone should have a home base online that is under their own control to the extent possible.
And not at the mercy of an algorithm or a commercial owner.
Right. I mean, my Twitter feed lasts as long as Twitter does, or until if someday Twitter decides that I don't belong there. I have no fundamental rights on anyone else's platform. And I hope people are thinking about these things. I think this re-centralization of our communications and technology is a very alarming thing.
Well, and I'm also struck by and I want to dig into with both of you, the way the content of what you produce is different because it is in this blog or website of your own making, as opposed to either the character limitation of a Twitter or even just sort of the format limitation of a Facebook post, let's say. You know, the blog, you can write it however you want. You can post whatever you want, and I guess I'm wondering if that is if we see that as a problem, that your expression is being limited by these other platforms in a way that blogs did not. I mean, Bev, what do you think?
Well, you know, I use Facebook and Twitter and Instagram sort of as mostly Facebook and Twitter just as a, hey, go over here and read this type of thing. I don't put a lot of focus on Facebook and especially Twitter. I hardly ever, I mean, I'm on it like once a day. And as opposed to the early days, I just, it's not me. Mm-hmm. But Facebook, the algorithm, some days it's on my side, some days it's not, you know? And so I really don't put a lot of stock in that.
When you don't pay for it, when you don't pay,
right. And I don't boost them. And yeah, I'm very like, I don't know.
You know, Dan, I mean, maybe another version of this question is, are we getting to know people, actual real people, the people behind the blogs, are we getting to know them less because people are getting their information more from these endless news feeds on Twitter and Facebook?
Interesting question. I'd love to see some research on that before I could even answer it. But we do know people who follow their friends on on the major platforms are at some level finding out more about what they're up to than if their friends blog occasionally. I don't know. Yeah. It's a good question.
I want to take one more call from a blogger that we know here at KCUR fairly well, Bonjwing Lee, who is one of the food critics sometimes here on Central Standard. Bonjwing, hello.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
It's good to talk to you again. And you came to prominence as a food writer with a blog, right?
Yes. And I just wanted to say that as your guest has been talking, I think I fit the textbook blogger mold. I mean, like one of your guests, I was in law school at the time that I started my blog in the early 2000s and really just wanted an outlet to write about my thoughts on food and the things that I loved, you know, food and travel. And at that time, there were not very many people doing that. And so I sort of inadvertently created a online resource for chefs. And that's sort of how my blog became known. I think the other thing that it ended up maybe backfiring on me, and it didn't turn out the way I intended it to be, but I also started doing it anonymously because I didn't think it was important who I was. I wasn't really writing it for anyone. I didn't think I would ever have an audience. And that later on became sort of another point that made people even more attracted to reading my blog, I think, because a lot of people were wondering, who is this guy who's writing, you know, doing all this stuff. So, and recently, what I wanted to say is that it is sad. I have not had time to write on my blog, and I miss it very much. I still would love to do it, but as your guests have also pointed out, I am one of those textbook bloggers where my blog sort of did launch a career for me. And so now I do this not blogging professionally. In fact, my blog has never had any advertising on it. I've never made really any money directly from the blog. But, you know, it did sort of launch this career now as, you know, for a freelance food writer and a photographer. And so I don't have the time, unfortunately, to do it. I still try to update it as often as I can, but it's sometimes months between, and that makes me very sad. But
so your blog has been the victim of your own success, as in a way.
You could say that, but I would also say that you know, I think the speed at which information is being disseminated in certain subcultures, which were what used to be subcultures, like the sort of geeky world traveling restaurant type people like I was at the time,
right,
is now not so much because there are many, many more people doing it now that it's caught on. And so the information being disseminated at a much more rapid pace has sort of what I can't, you know. My information is not going to be necessarily that much more valuable because you could go online and you could find dozens, if not hundreds, of other people talking about the exact same thing. Whereas when I started, I was really one of the only people oftentimes reporting about things that no one else had ever talked about or restaurants that very few had ever visited. Now that's not the case anymore. Now you have iPhones that, you know, you could take a picture from a restaurant.
Right.
Everyone's
a blogger on Yelp.
Right. Yeah. That's a combination of things, but I do miss it. And I think the other thing is that what social
quickly, Bonjwing.
Yes, is that they've shortened the conversation. You know, there's no patience for long form writing anymore, and I think that's that.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that very much. That's Bonjwing Lee, the ulterior epicure, who we unmasked a few years ago. Thanks so much for being with us, Bonjwing.
Thanks, Brian.
And just a quick last question to our other two guests, Dan Gilmore from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State, and also Bev Widener from the blog Bev Cooks. Do you guys see blogs having a bigger place in the information ecosystem going forward, or does that evolution eventually phase it out to be replaced by something else? Bev, what do you think?
Dan, you go first.
Dan, you go first.
I'm not nearly smart enough to predict the future of technology. Every time I think I know what's going to happen, something interesting and delightful or terrible happens to show that I really had no good imagination.
Okay, but you must have a hunch. I mean, give me what you think the next step is for blogs in any case.
I think the question we face now is whether companies like Google, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, et cetera, end up becoming essentially everything we do and the entire ecosystem, in which case there's not much future for blogging. I hope that does not happen. I hope that people reclaim the state where they did not need someone else's permission, but I'm not as confident as I'd like to be.
Well, and so, Bev, let me ask you a question that's maybe easier, which is, what's the future of your own blog? I mean, your kids are going to keep getting older. They're going to have a lot of demands. You've got these other things you're pursuing. Is keeping the blog up that important to you?
I will blog as long as it gives me joy and as long as I can do it.
All right. Well, that's Bev Widener, also Dan Gilmore. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
And when we come back, we move from the information ecosystem to the actual ecosystem and to how climate change may be affecting that food that we eat, its actual chemistry, and what that means for our nutrition and health. Stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison, Central Standard. We'll be right back. Welcome back to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. Our environment is changing. That much seems pretty clear from the science and of course, we've all heard the stories about the impact that's likely to have in years to come, or may already be having, flooding in coastal areas, rising temperatures, drought. But there's something else. Even where food is still growing, even where things may not even look all that different, our air is changing chemically, and that could have a big impact on the plants that grow and the animals, including us human animals who eat them. Joining us to unpack this a bit is Helena Bottomiller-Evich. She's the senior food and agriculture reporter at Politico. Hello, Helena.
Hi, how's it going?
It's great to have you here. And I know you're joining us from NPR there in Washington, where issues of climate change, its very existence perhaps in some minds, are very much a political football right now. But how does the research we're talking about today fit into that bigger question, those debates about climate change?
You know, this was such an interesting story to work on because you mentioned I'm here in Washington. I've actually been covering food and ag policy here for almost 8 years. And you're right, you hear about different climate issues, you hear about rising sea levels, you hear about projections with temperatures and how will that impact crop yields, will we have enough water? You hear about all these things, but no one had ever mentioned to me how rising CO2, which is something that's very measurable and not actually something we're debating. Like, we know that it's rising. We debate, maybe some people debate what's driving it. But no one had ever mentioned to me that rising CO2 actually affected the nutritional profile of crops and really affected most of the plants on the planet. And so the more I started learning about the emerging research on this, I just became fascinated with A, you know, what is the science, and B, you know, why isn't this more part of the conversation we're having about climate?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree. When I read your article, I thought, why haven't I heard about this? This feels really important. The headline of your article in Politico is "The Great Nutrient Collapse: The Atmosphere Is Literally Changing the Food We Eat for the Worse." That's pretty serious stuff. Walk us through how that is happening. You talk about the increase of carbon dioxide, CO2 in the atmosphere. So what? What is that? What difference does that make?
Yeah. So the good news is plants actually really like rising CO2. They grow faster in many cases. They might have better yields. So
seems like good
all
news.
Things else being equal, you're like, yeah, this sounds great. You know, it's a hidden benefit or an unexpected benefit, I guess, to this rising CO2 levels.
I bet there's a
but. But it turns out there is a there are consequences to this. And I think the simplest way to understand it is basically what happens is CO2 rising kind of revs up the photosynthesis of plants. So CO2 is one of the key inputs into photosynthesis, which is how, you know, plants transform sunlight and CO2 into the carbohydrates and other things that we eat. So that's the kind of the simplest way of understanding it. So rising CO2 revs up this process. The plants end up packing on more carbohydrates and, you know, things like glucose at the expense of protein, zinc, iron, other minerals. It's not a dramatic, impact. It's something that happens, if you look at how CO2 is projected to rise over the next 30, 40, 50 years, the research shows us that about 8% drop on average of these nutrients that I mentioned. So,
well, that seems
like a
pretty dramatic.
We're not talking about it.
Mm-hmm. That 8% seems like a pretty significant change in.
It's significant for sure.
Which leads me to wonder forgive me for interrupting you. My question is really, what would we notice this if it weren't for the scientists who are telling us that those numbers have changed? Does the food taste different to eat?
Well, I don't know that it is something we would necessarily notice, because one of the things I learned doing this piece is it's very difficult to compare food crops over time, because we're constantly changing them. So if you want to compare, let's say, a strawberry today to a strawberry we grew 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 50 years ago, we're growing different strawberries. We've selected them to be either bigger or more portable, or, you know, they last longer on the shelves. We're constantly breeding them. So it's very difficult to detect changes in nutrition over time. So what this research now is looking at is they're actually able to simulate higher CO2 levels and then control it against plants that are growing in the same exact climate and conditions, but just at ambient, CO2 levels. So that's how they're able to sort of isolate the CO2 impact. So
how long has this been going on?
We don't have a sense.
Yeah, you say over
time. Well, CO2's been rising, for a very long time. Before the Industrial Revolution, we were at about 280 parts per million. Today, we're over 400, I think more like 407 parts per million. And there are scientists who think we will probably be closer to 550 parts per million, maybe by 2050. So CO2 has been rising, and I think the point of the story is sort of that it's this factor that we probably haven't really been accounting for. It's very difficult to isolate, but we have science that shows CO2 has a clear impact on the quality of these crops. And by the way, it's not just crops. It's almost all plants. It's like 90 or 95% of plants will have their photosynthesis affected by rising CO2. So that raises a lot of questions. What about trees and the quality of wood? What about plants that we rely on for medicines or fiber, cotton? There really are a lot of questions that probably are deserving of some more research.
Wow, you're making this even more complicated. So if the food is actually changing, you talked about the CO2 essentially crowding out other nutrients like iron and zinc, I guess. What do we do about that? Do we need to eat more of the food? Do we need to change what we eat? What are the implications of this?
So the scientists I talked with were really hopeful that we'll be able to figure out what types of rice or what types of wheat might be the most resilient and might actually lose the fewest nutrients under highest CO2. So that all requires research. So first, just looking at how, I think there's like thousands of different cultivars of rice. Do they all react in the exact same way? Are there some that react more slowly? Those are all things that need to be researched. I think the other question is, can we modify the plants? Is CRISPR or gene editing or genetic modification, or are there ways we could be breeding plants to make them more resilient to this rising CO2? Also good questions, but the scientists I talked with were also quite concerned that we're not really focusing on this as much as we should, perhaps, because it takes a long time to figure out how to change plants or adapt to these changes.
And why aren't we? Why are research dollars not going to that? Is there some political agenda, or is it sort of an accident?
I think in general, there probably isn't enough plant-focused research. It's sort of an unsexy topic, mm-hmm. but certainly is important. So I think in general, agricultural research in the U.S. has just sort of stagnated, and you know, there's a real pressure in Washington to cut back, to find savings, just in general, just across the board. So I think agricultural research has been somewhat of a victim of that. But there's also the question of like crossing disciplines. So one of the most interesting things in this story is plant physiologists knew at least that protein was dropping in crops due to rising CO2 in like the 80s. Like there was a long history of plant physiologists going, oh yeah, this is something we sort of accepted was happening. But they didn't think about it holistically. They didn't really think about it outside of their discipline. So the nutrition world, the public health world was not part of the conversation. And so now what's happening is more research is sort of linking across and asking the question, what do these changes in plant physiology mean for public health? What does it mean in places like Bangladesh or India where they're much more reliant on rice? Well, what does it mean? And so those are the questions that are just starting to be asked.
So is rice an example of one of the crops that is perhaps more affected than others? And is that part of the issue that maybe America, where a lot of the research is done, is not going to have the most significant public health implications as in other parts of the world with less money, but perhaps greater dependence on these crops?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. In the U.S., we have so much food. You know, we're wasting a lot of food. We have so much food, right? We have plenty of meat at our disposal. We have plenty of protein at our disposal. There's every opportunity to eat a varied diet. But in places where they are much more dependent on plants for their protein, for their iron, for their zinc, for these key minerals, those are the places that most immediately researchers are worried about. So there's some initial modeling now being done to look at, well, what would happen to the, you know, billion moms and 350 million children who live in places where iron deficiency is already a pressing public health problem? Does, you know, this change, this drop in iron and rice, affect them? What does that mean? And those are the places where I think probably more research will be focused, because in the U.S., as you mentioned, we have, you know, we have a lot to eat here, and it's probably not, you know, the imminent, the imminent questions are much more about the developing world.
Well, and it strikes me that the very first thing you said about carbon dioxide actually causing more yield, in some cases helping plants grow better, will be initially greeted with joy in these places where food deficiency is the issue.
Absolutely. And the Gates Foundation just this week actually announced a $50 million project to sort of look at photosynthesis and trying to figure out how to boost yields and sort of harness that. Because there is a lot of hope that maybe you can leverage the yield increases from rising CO2 into addressing food insecurity. Because as we all know, there's a lot of concern about how we're going to feed the planet in the years to come.
I have a question from a caller. And Keith, there's not much time left, but Keith from Kansas City, what's your question for our guest?
Hi, good. Thanks for covering this topic. I've been following you on your posts. But my question is my plant breed, and I look at different systems and how that affects, and I was wondering how elevated temperatures and CO2 are affecting soil microbiota, so the microbes in the soil and such.
Right. Good question. Thanks so much, Keith.
Helena? Yeah, that's a really good question, and I'm not sure if researchers are zeroing in on controlling, you know, or simulating high CO2 and rising temperatures and looking at how the soil changes. That's probably worth more research. One of the debates I found is scientists somewhat debate how best to study these things, because if you're going to control temperature and CO2 in an experiment, you have to put things in a greenhouse. Is a greenhouse really, you know, simulating the outside environment? There's a lot of debate about how to do this, and researchers kind of have to figure out, you know, how best to experiment and answer these questions to better position us to adapt to them.
That's Helena Bademiller-Evich. She's the senior food and agriculture reporter at Politico. Her article, which is called The Great Nutrient Collapse, The Atmosphere is Literally Changing the Food We Eat for the Worse and Almost Nobody is Paying Attention, is right now online on Politico. Thanks so much, Helena, for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You can listen back to this discussion at kcur.org/centralstandard. It includes our earlier talk about the evolution of blogging, all at kcur.org/centralstandard. Today's conversation can continue on Twitter. We're at KCURCST, and I'm at PTS Brian. Check us out there. Tomorrow, a portrait session with Lawrence-based singer Vanessa Thomas. Join Gina Kaufman back here tomorrow at 10. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. We get help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Brian Ellison. Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.